You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway.
You're listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast with your host, Tony Award winner, Ken Davenport.
Hey, everybody. In just a few moments, we're going to get to Michael John Lacusa and this week's podcast, where he's going to talk about how cold calling Hal Prince helped jumpstart his career and the three things he tells his Tisch writing students. It's a great podcast, so we'll get to it in a second. But before we do, I wanted to tell you about this week's sponsor, AJV Media, a company that video records live events, actor reels, corporate presentations, legal proceedings, even human interest interviews and crowdfunding campaign videos. AJV Media plans, adapts, and delivers, and they're available for you. Again, we use this company all the time. They're very professional. They're very, very quick, which says a lot in our industry. So if you're interested, go check them out. You can find AJV Media at ajvmedia.com. And now let's hear from Michael John.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Today, I am thrilled to have with me in my office the five-time Tony-nominated Michael John Lacusa. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, sir. Thank you for having me.
So you probably first think of Michael John as a composer. I know that's probably what comes to my mind when I think, but he's actually a composer, a lyricist, book writer as well. He's one of those that does it all. In fact, I found it interesting that three of your five Tony nominations are for Best Book.
That's
Is that true?
He's
the author of First Lady Suite, First Daughter Suite, Giant and More, as well as Hello Again, Marie Christine and the Wild Party. So I want to go back to your youth. What was the first musical you ever saw?
My youth. I'm still in my youth. Ken, dear. My first musical I ever saw was Camelot, I believe, in a high school production of Camelot.
Were you in it or were you just...
No, as a child. I must have been like 5 years old or something like that. So I do remember it very, very clearly.
And were you taken to it?
Smitten. People were living what was going on in my brain every day as a five-year-old. They were singing and telling the story at the same time. It just was like, I live there. You know, I don't know why. It was just immediate.
Were you a musician at this point? Had you picked up anything yet?
Five, no. But I was starting to write words to nursery rhymes that already had songs to them, for instance, or rewriting the lyrics to Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
So words came before music.
Not that they needed any rewriting, but I was, you know, I mean, well, that was it. But I also sang too as a kid too. I was a singer as well.
And when did you decide that...
Not today, as you could tell with my voice. No singing.
When did you decide that writing or the theater was something you wanted to be involved in for good, if you will?
I had a fourth grade teacher named Mrs. Hammer, and you never did anything that Mrs. Hammer didn't want you to do, or you did everything that Mrs. Hammer wanted you to do. And I wrote a musical for my fourth grade class, and they did it, and it was fun. And then she came to me afterwards. She went, "When you grow up, you're going to write musicals." And I just never had any other thing that I was going to do because Mrs. Hammer told me that was what I was going to do. It's a true story.
Has she seen your shows?
Yes, she did. She got to see several of them before she passed.
Oh.
Yeah, it was great.
I bet.
Yeah, it was wonderful sharing what my career was with her eventually.
I loved how you were like, "Oh yeah, so I wrote a musical in the fourth grade, just like you do."
Just like you do, right? That's what I'm saying. It's weird. It's just like it just always was what I wanted to do.
What was that musical?
It was some kind of cross between Wizard of Oz, obviously a big reference in my life, and the ESLA, Patty Hearst and something. It was like, you know, with machine guns, you know, Wizard of Oz with machine guns or something.
Do you remember a song?
No, I don't. I don't remember anything.
Does it exist anywhere?
I don't know. Maybe in some box in one of my brother's, you know, houses or something like that. I don't know.
Just always angling for a revival. I'm always looking for something that hasn't been done.
There is stuff that should not ever be done again. Yes.
And so that was the first musical that you wrote. What was the second or the first real serious attempt where you were like, "Okay, I'm sitting down. I'm going to do this now for real"?
It became very serious for me to really pursue the career as a writer when I moved to New York. And it wasn't until about 1982 to 83 where I was involved with the 78th Street Theater Lab there, a wonderful couple, Mark Zeller and Dana Zeller Alexis. And I worked for them as an accompanist, as a music director and vocal coach, etc. And I was starting to make a career doing that. And I recognized that you can get pigeonholed very, very quickly. In New York, if you're talented, you can play. I could sight read and I could sight transpose, and I was a good accompanist. And I went, I don't want to do that. I came here to write musicals. So I forswore all the piano playing and music director jobs and went to go work at Tower Records Classical and then really put my nose to the grindstone and began writing musicals, joined the BMI workshop, which was very, very important, very influential for me because I met a lot of my mentors through that. Ellen Fitzhugh, the great lyricist, Maury Yeston, Alan Mink, and Ed Kleban, great lyricist, you know. So it was great. It was a great experience. But that's really about 1983 I began really writing and began showing work to various people around town. Ira Whitman at Lincoln Center, for instance, or Wiley Halsum at ICM became an agent. And it's the networking that went on normally and just had to keep doing it, you know. My first show, I think, that got recognition for myself might have been Buzzsaw Berkeley, that I wrote with Doug Wright and the wonderful Chris Ashley. A hysterically funny book. It was done at the WPA Theater down in Chelsea at the time. And the theater's no longer there. But it was Doug came up with the idea of a mashup between Mickey and Judy movies and slasher movies. And it was wonderful for me as the composer and songwriter for the piece to be able to end every song in a death. It was very, very exciting to end with a, you know, murder at the end of every song. So, and I remember Lynn Ahrens, who I knew from the Beat My Workshop, she said, "You know what your problem is, Michael John? You don't know how to button a song." So when I finally wrote Buzzsaw Berkeley, I said, "Come on, see." I said, "You guys, so they were the best buttons because everybody died at the end of their song that they sang."
I want to go back to something you said, which I think was obviously a very courageous and strong thing that you did, which was turn down a whole bunch of work.
Yes.
Because I hear this, you know, once you can prove that you have a certain level of ability, which you said you could sight read, you could transpose, this industry will put you on a track and throw you a lot of work. And a lot of people have a hard time turning that stuff down. It's good money.
Well, you have to keep a roof over your head. You have to feed yourself. If you have a family, you've got to devote, you know, the resources to maintaining a lot of things. And New York is not a cheap city.
So you say all those things. So think back, what gave you the courage and the confidence to be like, you know what, screw that stable paycheck, which you, I'm sure, could have been conducting on Broadway very young, very early, making good money, pension, all that stuff. How did you say no to that for a cashier job at Tower Records?
It just was compulsion, obsession, desire, those things that you can't go to sleep at night if you're not going to do what it is that makes you the most happy, you know, and I feel, or to give you the most fulfillment. And what is my purpose for being here except to write musicals? You know, it just never crossed my mind. And of course, I'm absolutely stupid too to do it all too. As I tell my students at NYU, I go, God, you're dumb to be doing this. It's crazy. It's insane that you want to pursue a career doing this. But at the same time, follow your happiness. You know, you have to. Otherwise, what's the point? You know it as well. You know it as well, Kat.
I certainly do. I want to ask you about the BMI workshop.
Yep.
Because of all the composer lyricists I know, I would immediately not put you in the BMI workshop bucket because of the types of shows that you do. So talk to me about what you learned, why it was valuable for you, or even the things that you were like, oh, this is amazing, but this is actually not what I have to forget. Because you do real adventuresome stuff.
Well, that's a great question. Well, I feel like if you don't have craft under your belt and learn what made the great musicals, what makes a great song a great song, unless you know that, you can't go throwing the plates against the wall. You know, if that's your goal, if you want to switch things up, you have to know what you're switching up. You just don't go out there and, you know, do things. You have to know what the craft is. Craft is essential. Craft is what you can fall back on in the really hard times too when you're putting on a show. You know, when you need to do that rewrite immediately, craft is what's going to get you through the day, not artistry. You know, because it's craft will get you through the business parts of things too. Knowing how to rewrite, knowing how a lyric works, knowing how a piece of music should work. You need to know those things. And that was what was very, very helpful about the BMI workshop to me. And also too, like I said, great mentors who were very hard, very, very hard on me. And I think that was really essential too, to say, no, you can't get away with that rhyme. You can't get away with that. That makes no sense. And even though it might have been to a certain degree frustrating to me to go, but that's me, that I want to say it that way. But I mean, that was not the place to do that. It was to learn how to do it right and then go off. And I knew when I reached my limit there at the BMI workshop, I knew come the third year when it was, you know, that I wanted to go off and explore a little bit more. And so you know when you're supposed to stay there and you know when you're supposed to leave. But it was still very invaluable for me at the time. It's about learning craft. If you can't get away with it, you have to, you know it too. As producer, there's a craft involved in producing. And so many people don't think that there is. To be a successful producer, you know, it is because of your craftsmanship that you've been able to be a successful producer. Same thing for a writer, you know. Now I choose different things to do. I'm not, I don't skew commercial, although I could if I wanted to. It's just that world doesn't jive with me right now, where my place in life right now, where I'm at right now.
So talk to me a little bit about that.
Excuse me.
Talk to me a little bit about that, because I was going to ask you that exact question. You are obviously talented enough to be able to write, I'm sure, whatever you wanted to write if someone gave you a quote-unquote task. Like if someone said, hey, there was this blockbuster movie that grossed, you know, $1 billion last year, we're going to do a musical version of it. Would you like to write that?
Yes.
You would?
I would give it 2 seconds, but no one comes to me with them.
Really?
Know? No, I'm too esoteric, apparently, or something. I don't know what it is. I'd be writing to, I've won 3 Emmys doing Wonder Pets on TV. It's the most commercial piece of, you know, TV on the planet. You know, did a lot of, you know, that's my commercial thing. It's not like I can't do it. You know, that's part of the craft, too. You have to learn how to do that as well. I've been fortunate, though, to be able to do something that's just a little bit outside the box. I really enjoy living there. And it's not that it's certainly harder to do it, what I do. Much more harder. And I love the challenge. I think is probably the greater thing. because I think probably OCD or something like that. What is it called when you can't?
ADD.
ADD, that thing. Yes, whatever. Just one of those things. I know. I'm not good with the diseases. I have that probably where I get bored really quickly, you know, and I have to constantly keep myself challenged. If it's, you know, because it's fun to be in dangerous territory, you know, knowing that you can't musicalize Medea. That's awful. Musicals can't have children killed at the end. Well, I'm going to write that one.
So where do you get those ideas? I mean, I've heard, I think it was Kendra and Ab, someone was like, every time we hear that a show or we think a show can't be musicalized, that's when we do
it. That's right, uh-huh.
Is that...
John Kendra is a great example, great mentor, one of them.
So how do you find an idea and go, that one, I'm going to do Medea, or I'm going to do that and a Ferber novel, or I'm going to, like, what strikes
you? There are so many factors that go into it. In the case of Giant, for instance, that was Edna Ferber's great niece, Julie Gilbert, who came to me with it. And I turned it down because I didn't know what to do with, you know, a 5,000-page book about 25 years of Texas history. I mean, what was I going to do with that? How would I do that? But then I spread it again, and then I said yes to her because I realized, oh, I can do anything with this. I can make it a 3-night thing if I want to do this. How crazy would that be? Make it epic. Make it epic. So, and in the case of Marie-Christine, that was something that just came through a whole variety of sources. You know, I tell my students at NYU, I think that the Renaissance can be greatly overrated sometimes, because in the medieval times, people believed that the genies lived in the walls, and that if you're smart enough and astute enough and bright enough and quick enough, you could grab the genie by the tail. And the Renaissance, of course, teaches us that genius resides in us. Well, I don't necessarily know about that. I do know that if you're aware of the world around you, the ideas are just always around you for something creative to spark in you and to make that happen and turn it into a musical story. You know it too. You wrote your own book for getting the band back together. You know, something must have made you want to do that. It's not like, right? I mean, can you put your finger on that? No, it was something that came your way. And you went, I must do this, and your heart's desire, you know, came true. That's what it's all about.
You sometimes do all three elements of a musical, and sometimes you collaborate. Do you have a preference?
Well, it's lonely doing all three. I mean, it's really lonely and kind of schizophrenic, too, you know, because you walk around the house yelling at yourself. You know, the composer's yelling at the lyricist is yelling at the book writer, blah, 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 you know. And it also, collaboration is the best thing. That's what makes theater, you know. I find it expedient to sometimes do all three things. And it depends on the type of show I want to write. If it's a lyrical musical, in other words, if the story is told primarily through lyric, sung words, then I prefer to write my own book for that. If it's something like Giant, where I need a helping hand to wrestle that beast into some sort of sturdy, dramatic structure, I need to have a great playwright to work with Sybil Pearson, for instance, was my collaborator for that. And I prefer working with collaborators because, like I say, that's really what makes theater, is working with other people. So it's a matter of expediency or what the project I feel demands. If I feel like I need a book writer to work with, I will go and get one. I won't be egotistical about it. You know, you have to have that.
How do you maintain your objectivity when you're doing all three? How do you yell at each other and settle those arguments?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if I should be objective. I think that's the director's job, maybe, is to have an objective eye, or the producer's eye is to be that. I mean, I trust my producers the most, you know, the people outside of the actual creative process, but enough in it that they are the ones that can be objective for me. Because I think the best producers that I've worked with have always allowed me that complete freedom to make mistakes and rewrite, or, you know, and to sit back and go, yes, or, you know what, no, we need to do this here. This is what needs to happen. And being very protective of me too as well. So I don't know if I need to be objective as a writer when I do it, if I have good producers behind me.
You have a story of one of those good producers who helped you through a moment of a show?
Oh, yeah, wonderful. Scott Rudin was amazing to work with when I did the Wild Party on Broadway with George C. Wolfe. I and also not just Scott, the whole four other producers. These days there's like 29 producers to a show. Back in those days, four was a lot. I swear to God, I was like circling the wagons around me. I was not privy to a lot of other drama that was happening on stage and off. You know, I was just, my job was to be the writer of the score and to write the best score that I could possibly write. And I felt so protected the whole journey through by these wonderful producers led by Scott. And I think that was really, you know, that's when I learned from that experience what a good producer is and how protective they are of the artist.
It was a very strange time because, of course, there was that other wild party going on.
Yeah, and the show was happening off Broadway at the same time, too. Isn't that ironic?
How was that for you at that time, knowing that was going on? It just seems like, first of all, I don't think that would ever happen today. I just don't think we would do that.
You never know. I mean, it's happened. It's not the first time in history the same type of show. I mean, Phantom of the Opera is a great example. Arthur Covet and Maury Esten's version happened virtually at the same time as Andrews, Sir Andrews, Lord Andrews. What was he now?
He's just Andrew.
He's Andrew. It happens. And also, too, you never know what's going to happen to your musical. You never know. You know, ours could have folded at any stage in the workshop process, any stage in the reading process could have folded. So could have Andrew Lipa's version. We never know. So we have to keep moving forward on whatever trajectory it is. And if it reaches its goal of getting produced, it's produced. And, you know, I always think there's room for both versions of the piece. They're both so quite different, you know. Mine's more, Andrew's is more, I think, audience or user-friendly is what I like to say. I always know when the college or university that does that version of the Wild Party, I always know they probably didn't find the singers for it all. And mine is very racially diverse. George and mine, we made our specifically. We need to have a very diverse cast to do our show.
It was very ahead of its time, actually.
It was, exactly right. It was very much so. And it's challenging musically. You know, so you have top to do our version of the Wild Party. But not to say that there's anything not hard about Andrews either. But there's a way the world can hold both of them, that's what I feel.
Do you read reviews?
Yes, of course I do.
You say, of course you do. Like, of course I must, because...
I must. It's business. I need to know what the business is of it all. Well, how can I, if it's a great review, I want to know that it's a good review, so I can use that to possibly help with publication, finding the way to get that show to have an extra life after its initial opening. So for business reasons, yes. If it's not a good review, I have to know that and how to play that. I have to also read it. And now a lot of people don't. And I always say, well, if you read the good reviews, you have to, you know, and you believe the good reviews, you have to believe the bad reviews. And a lot of people don't read the reviews, and I understand why they don't. My personal thing is, yeah, I read everything because I'm interested in what they're saying. I'm actually interested in what critics have to say. And it's saddening to me that the critical environment in our city here is almost nil. I mean, with the papers going left and right, and where do you find good criticism anymore? I don't know if you find it in a lot of the blogs or the people just writing on Facebook or tweeting stuff like that. And, you know, I don't know if that's criticism anymore. I miss that. And there were so many great critics back when I was starting out that I loved reading. I mean, John Simon, I still love reading John Simon, one of the bright ones, you know, one of the great ones. Frank Rich was terrific, too. He's, you know, the good writers. And you learn something from the good writers who write about theater. And Michael Feingold, for instance, I always find very fascinating to read. And I miss that extra voice out there in the world. Now it's just all snark.
I find it interesting that you read them primarily for the business aspect of it. In thinking, so you really have to think of your career and all of your things that you do as a business.
Yes, of course. Yes. It is a business. It's called show business, you know? Yeah, of course you could think business, you know? I can't imagine any young writer wanting to be in the business not thinking about how to support oneself in the business and how to make one's work have the life outside of its original production.
Let's go back to
the recordings that you need to have to document the piece, you know, the publication, the distribution rights for the piece. All those things have to be thought of as writing. You have to think of those things in advance of your show opening.
Let's go back to the beginning of your career again, because you said something very,
excuse me,
very quickly oh, you know, I was doing all that networking and things like that, and it sounded very easy to you. And I think that's probably hard for a lot of young writers, especially now. How did you get the attention of the public back in the day, of all these people back in the day when you were just starting out writer?
Well, I mean, through people who heard my work. You know, I didn't make any... I would get on the phone. Remember when there were phones and phone books? I would go through the phone book and call people.
Cold call people.
Yeah, call Hal Prince.
You cold called Hal Prince?
Yeah.
And just said...
Hi. You know what I mean? What should I do for my work? Blah, blah, blah. Or walk into somebody's office or walk into somebody's theater and say, hi. You know, I just did that. I mean, I just did that.
And was, tell me a...
I would do it to you if you were around back when I was a kid.
And...
But I reached out to you. I mean, I reached out to people just, you know, not because I want something from them all, but because I think that they're doing good work. And I'm curious about what it is that they do. And... You know, and it's fascinating to me. You know, I loved you once on the Silent Revival, for instance. I thought it was one. My friend Jenna was also a producer now. And I told her she was going to win the Tony. You guys were going to, I told you too.
You did.
And I said, you guys are going to win the Tony, even though you're able against two, you know, behemoths of the theater, you know, and wonderful productions in and of themselves. But I knew you guys were going to do that. And it fascinated me how you marketed that show. That to me was really, like, cool. Really cool. And I love that Jenna was learning how to do that, too, through working with you, too. She's a wonderful actress. She was in my movie Hello Again. I love that girl so much. So it's a learning process. And so why can't you pick up the phone and call someone? Back in the day, also, too, there were more shows happening at a rapid time than were, like, the British things that sit there in the theaters for so long. So there were... Even though there wasn't a lot back in the early 80s, there was enough so that you could constantly see people out. And you knew that you could go to Sardi's and you might run into Cy Coleman there, or you might run into John Kander there, even Sondheim or something. You could run into people, and you talk with them and pass on little things, hear their opinions, you know, get that energy going. You know, that was the community back then. Now that shows don't open as frequently as they do, and if they do, they all happen within the same 1 week, you know, in October or April. You don't get that sense of community anymore. You find it now more in some of the programs, like the program that I teach at NYU, where we do have writers, and it's strictly about, well, how I could share with them what it is I've learned from others.
You mentioned the Tony Awards. You are a Tony nominator, yes?
My third year.
Third year. Have you enjoyed that process? Stressful?
It's hard when the crunch happens. I don't know why everybody feels they must open in April. So, you know, because to get in under the wire, because it becomes a daze sometimes, because you're going to the theater, you know, eight times a week sometimes with the amount of shows that are opening with boom, boom, boom energy. I wish they kind of spread it out. But again, that's business, I guess, and they have to try to get it into the under the Tony wire. So, but it's been an enormous responsibility and a great privilege to be a Tony nominator. You see a lot of shit. You know, you see a lot of really just mind-blowingly, like, what is this? But it's all assuaged by seeing some fun stuff. Like your show, they're the band. They're getting the band back together. A couple great performances and plays that are just, you know, blow your brain out. You know, Glenda Jackson, Three Tall Women was amazing. Laurie Metcalf and Doll's House. So these are indelible things. Or incredible experiences like going to see, you know, all of Angels in America all together. Or George Wolfe's remarkable production of Iceman Cometh. That 5-hour thing. So those are things that I might not have been able to see, given my schedule, for one thing. And also, to the price of it all is quite steep. So to see all those shows, you know, at one thing, it's impossible to do, you know, in anybody's budget, I would think, you know. So that's been a great privilege to be a nominator. But there is a lot of, whoa, you go, whoa, whoa, what? How'd I get here? You know, there is that thing. I mean, I'm not supposed to talk about anything specific, but I think that's pretty much a general consensus among.
We'll talk about that when the mic's off. So you do also teach at NYU.
Yes, I do.
What do you find is the most common lesson you have to give new writers coming up? What do you find yourself repeating over and over to folks?
Be yourself. Be honest. And be unafraid of challenging yourself. Those are the three things that I think that are good mantras to live by. You know, there are more technical things like don't edit yourself.
What does that mean?
Don't, while you're in the process of writing, don't start editing yourself until you've written something, and then you can go back and do some editing.
So puke up a first draft, just get it out.
Exactly. The dirty play.
That's how you write?
Oh, yeah. Just the dirty thing. Just get something out there. Write a song a day. It doesn't matter if anybody's going to hear it or not. Are you going to make a Grammy, you know, album out of it all? No. Write the song a day, good or bad. Write something every day. You have to. It's called practice. You know, you have to be a good pianist. You practice. You be a good golfer. What do you practice every day, don't you? So, you know, you got to do that and to be good at what you do. And but not to edit yourself while you're doing it. Not to be, you know, going, oh, I'm not good enough, or that's not good enough. Don't go into that place because you'll never write anything. So that's like a technical thing that I'm showing. Just be true to yourself. I mean, it's really to be honest. And, you know, just be honest with yourself.
I know.
Are you happy doing this?
I know you talked about being disappointed with some shows that open and how did they get here. But overall, how do you think Broadway's doing today in the state of the American musical? How do you think we're doing?
Great. I mean, it's amazing. I think it's in wonderful shape. I think it's thrilling to see. Everybody wants to do musicals. You know, they've been saying over and over again, the American musical is dead. Well, you know, and then it's not. There's other places where it comes from. The Broadway musical, the musical created for Broadway may not exist specifically for Broadway anymore. We find it in other places and we bring it to Broadway. That's a fundamental change. There are many musicals. I mean, The Wild Party was created to be on Broadway. But there are very few that come along that way. And I think it was one of the last ones that was specifically created. A lot of things are found regionally now. Musicals are done regionally. And so that's another wonderful world of possibilities out there for young writers to find. Worlds in which the regional theaters are doing new work and daring work too at that. So that's very, very exciting to see. And of course, Off-Broadway, which is getting a little expensive and with rents going up and spaces being, you know, hard to find. That's tricky now. I'm wondering to see what'll happen with them. Some of these new tax cuts, and we're curious to see what's going to happen for our not-for-profits. It could be very, very detrimental to our not-for-profits. I don't know. You probably know better than I about that situation, what will happen with not-for-profits. So we'll have to keep an eye on that to see how that will affect, because, you know, not-for-profits can't write off anymore. So we'll see what happens with that. It could be dangerous.
And you mentioned Wild Party was written for Broadway. When you sit down to write something new, do you think about a destination now? Do you think,
space.
Space.
Think of space. If I imagine a piece in a big space, you know, there's something that you create in the score, in the music, or the palette, I like to think of, the colors that I would choose. Giant, for instance. I always knew it was going to be in a large space. It had to be because it was giant. I don't want it in a, you know, I'm not going to do it in a black box. So the colors were red, white, and blue. I mean, I really painted with primary colors with that piece. So the piece has that scope musically and everything. For First Daughter Suite or First Lady Suite, which I knew would be done off-Broadway, chamber-ish. I hate the word chamber musical. I don't know what it means. I always think of chamber maid or chamber pot whenever you hear that. But it is, it's an easy enough term that people can identify with. I knew that I wanted it intimate. And because I wanted it to be like a microscope on these women that I was writing about. So therefore, my music could be a little bit more intricate, more complicated, if you will, complex, let me put it that way. So space was very important, is important for me. Now, Broadway, I don't know, because some of the theaters here are so intimate and so beautiful. I mean, I love the new Second Stage Home so much. I love the new the Helen Hayes. It's adorable. But even like something like the Richard Rogers is intimate. you know, you love those theaters, you know. I loved what they did with the Harry Potter theater. I call it the Harry Potter theater now. I don't know why. Because I couldn't believe that old airplane hangar was suddenly became something so beautiful to sit in for. I hope they keep it there forever. It suddenly became very intimate. So that's, you know, there's a lot of houses on Broadway that actually could be great for the smaller musicals, more intimate musicals.
What I love about this conversation already is you're so positive, courageous. You throw up those first drafts. You don't edit yourself. Like, this business, however, can be disappointing at times.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure you've had moments in your career when you've been disappointed. How do you deal with that and go on to what's next?
Oh, I take the old adage of Hal Prince. You know, the next morning after you open the show, you go into work on the new piece. You should already have your new piece ready to go. And then you're not so worried about if people didn't like it or it's going to flop or close. You're onto your next work. Onto the next thing. Don't look back. You can't look back. You know, no regrets except, you know, learn from them, if you will. But don't look back. You just got to keep moving forward. You know, life's short. Get as much done as you can. Have fun doing it, too.
All right, my last question, which is my genie question.
Genie question.
I want you to imagine the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you and says, Michael John, I'm going to grant you one wish. What's the one thing in this business that drives you so crazy, gets you angry, frustrated, would have you banging your head against the piano that you'd ask this genie to wish away in an instant?
The thing that right now, where I'm at right now in my life, is roles for women and how women are depicted on stage, particularly in American musical. And I would like to have that changed. I'd like to have more complex roles, deeper roles. And that's not just, you know, I mean, and diversity, please. You know, so that I could have what I see in the world when I walk outside my door on, you know, 105th and Columbus. I want to see the world that I see on the stage, and I want to hear it singing. And I wish that we took more chances with that, with our writers, who are a lot of talented writers out there that still have yet to, I guess that's why I write, is to fill a void that I'm seeing. So that would be the thing that I wish the genie could make happen. And in lieu of the genie, I'll do some work on my own to make sure that those roles are created.
I love it. Taking wishes into your own hands.
You got it.
Well, thank you for that. Thanks so much for joining us today, everyone out there, and we'll see you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.